Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had...
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tomorrow Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 5, NASDAQ futures down 12, so not much going on. We had a record Dow session yesterday. A couple stocks were up, but the rest of the market was kind of flat and boring. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning. Yes, you do.
Professor, Mr. AI dude, why don't you help Andrew get our intro from $1 million to $1 billion with this inflation?
Well, I would submit the recording and ask it to change $1 million to $2 million to billion and see what it comes back with.
Or could we get ahead of it and make it a trillion? We don't need that yet.
No, we don't need that yet. If you can do it, if you can do it real easily, up it to $1 billion, then it won't be hard to make it into $1 trillion eventually.
Well, that's true. How long do you think we got to go before we make it $1 trillion? A couple of years?
No, nothing so fast. It'll be at least 5.
God. So how are you? How are you? You and the guys are reliving the game Saturday, picking out plays and stuff. I saw that yesterday. Our guys need a job, some of them, I think.
Well, yeah, but you got to admit, you know, if you're a Notre Dame fan and you just push Southern California around the field, that's glorious. And this may be, you know, the end of the series. USC is seeing about ending the series. So as far as I'm concerned, ending the series on a 3-game winning streak where you know what they did was literally manhandle them on the offensive line and run up incredible rushing yardage. I think, you know, and with the week off this week, I think you can revel in that a little bit.
I think so too. I don't know the full history of it, but I think it's always kind of as we age, mature, I'll say. And people don't, a lot of people are a lot younger, yes. The history of some of this stuff is really something kind of that you wouldn't believe. I'm not even sure how this one got started, but somebody somewhere at Notre Dame, I mean, basically, if you've ever been there, the joke was when Father Soren camped at the lakes, there's two lakes there, he said, We'll leave when the weather gets better, or something, was the comment?
Yeah, that was the Ted Hesburgh. Father Hesburgh used to tell that story at orientation weekend for freshmen every year, where they said the explorers, including the Holy Cross priests, were traveling across northern Indiana, and a storm blew up, and so they pitched camp, and they all agreed that they would leave when the weather improved.
But there's two lakes, and there's a river there, so it was a pretty good spot, really, to land. At that time, the St. Joe River might have ended up being there was a big debate between whether the Chicago was going to be the hookup between the Lake Michigan and the Mississippi, or maybe the St. Joe River to the Kankakee River instead of the Chicago River to the Des Plaines River. And obviously, Chicago won out on that, and the rest is history. I mean, that's what...
Well, a lot of people don't know that the St. Joe River is the reason South Bend has its name. It's, you know, it empties into Lake Michigan up in St. Joseph, Michigan, about 25 to 30 miles north of the Michigan-Indiana line. But from if you follow it from there, it comes down to South Bend.
Well, and somebody, I don't know who the
it takes a turn and then heads back up into Michigan after that.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting history. Well, somebody somewhere, and I think this happened first. I mean, football started, and for those who don't know, doesn't if you actually look at a national titles, doesn't Yale have like a whole bunch more than anybody else? If you go all the way back to when football started, I think it's Yale. They won like every year during the 1800s. But then Army, the Naval, the Academy started to have teams, and somebody in South Bend at Notre Dame said, well, you know, we need to break out of this and become more than just a little, you know, 2,000 student place on the prairie, basically. And somebody got his hair up his behind to schedule a game with Army. And they said, well, how the hell are you going to get there? Well, they ended up piling on the train and took all kinds of chow from the dining hall because they didn't have money to eat along the way. And they went out there, and I think they beat Army or at least came close or something. And all of a sudden, it kind of put them on the map because now they did one out east. And then they said, okay, well, I don't know if Rockne was into movies big time. Matter of fact, he was making $100,000 a year as a coach when he died. And years and years later, what did Era make? 60? Or something along those lines? But matter of fact, when his plane went down, it wasn't anything he was doing for the school. He was going out to L.A. to sign up for a movie. He was an operator, that guy. Anyway, but he decides, we need to have a West Coast exposure, so we're going to go play Southern Cal. And that's why it was always on Thanksgiving weekend, because the away game, because essentially you got to Chicago, you probably took the South Shore, known as the Vomit Comet, to Chicago. You hopped on a plane, train, and L.A. was two nights in a day. It was 36 hours to get from Chicago to L.A., or 40 hours, or some incredible number. And they would go out there on Thanksgiving weekend every other year and play Southern Cal. So essentially, they got to both coasts early on. And that's how it all started. Otherwise, you'd think that you'd find somebody to...
Legend has it that the coaches' wives were the ones behind scheduling the... getting the USC-Notre Dame series started. So I don't know how true that is, but they hit it off really well, and they liked playing. They liked getting to see each other regularly. So that was behind the series. But, yeah, when you talk about the big upset over Army, of course, there was the famous 1924 one where Grantland Rice had one of the great all-time openings to where he said, outlined against a blue-gray October sky, the Four Horsemen rode again. In dramatic lore, they are known as Famine, Pestilence, Destruction, and Death. These are only aliases. Their real names are Stoltreyer, Miller, Crowley, and Layden. They formed the crest of the South Bend Cyclone, before which another fighting Army team was swept over the precipice at the Polo Grounds this afternoon as 55,000 spectators peered down upon the bewildering panorama spread out upon the green plain below.
What a Polo Grounds.
Nobody writes for sports like that anymore.
No, God, no. No Grantland Rice around for sure. I mean, how many? Those guys wrote like six days
a week. When I was writing, I never had that gift. I mean, there are maybe two or three articles I wrote where I'm really, really proud of, you know, how I worded things and what the content was. And that's out of I don't know how many. I was more. You know, I'm good as a technical writer. I can, you know, I'll structure things right. I'll make it very readable. I can do all of that kind of stuff, but I don't have that gift for words.
Oh, yeah, those guys, plus they wrote 6 days a week. I mean, nobody does that anymore. Just a whole different sort of ethic. I mean, it's before our time, but Grantland Rice also wrote Casey's Revenge. Who wrote the original one, Casey at the Bat?
New with Mexico?
No. Who wrote the original one, Casey at the Bat?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember his name. Who was it?
Well, it came out in the San Francisco Chronicle. The guy was Ernest Thayer. And like a year later, Grantland Rice wrote Casey's Revenge, where he came back and kicked ass. Got to come back and kick ass if you strike out, right? That's America. He just saying. But I mean, you know, there was no way to describe this stuff. I mean, people that, guys like in the movie The Natural, guys like, you know, Robert Duvall's character, Max Mercy, they were your link to sports. There was an article, and it was always a cartoon with a star in there showing what's happening. It was always like a, what do you call it? It's like a political cartoon. What do they call that type of drawing where you, everything is in, you know, it's all black and white, but it's like a political, what do they call those guys? I don't know the artistic term, but.
Right, you're driving it. So, yeah, I know what you're describing. I just don't know the word.
I remember, though, who was the guy who used to write Nixon every night, and every day he told a lie, his nose got a little bigger that night in the picture. His ears got bigger. Finally, near the end, Nixon's ears and nose were so big he couldn't even see his head, right? He was a caricature. He was. Okay. Nixon had the greatest. He wasn't a bad looking guy, but he somehow or another he really lent himself to being a caricature, didn't he?
Yeah, he was good for caricature.
And some, you know, some people aren't, but some are. I mean,
good for caricature too.
So what do you make of? Well, we've got gold has been getting clobbered the last couple of days, and the interesting part there is, thank God we got puts. That's the interesting part, but. Bitcoin was down with gold in the morning, and then it came back, where gold did not bounce, and it's down again today. It's down, pushing $300 in 2 days. It was 4,300. Now it's like 4,000. That's a lot. I mean, it ran up real fast, but now it's running down real fast. This stuff gets the volatility in individual areas, Kevin, is really something, and it's making me very nervous, to be honest with you, because my friends in the business that. You know, provide, make markets, they call them, you know, liquidity providers now, whatever all that means. They're essentially big firms that send, they make markets in all these different stocks and futures and whatever else there is. I think they're getting jammed up by some of the amount of volume and being in keeping under risk parameters. The other day when the VIX went from 18 to 25 in like 2 days, that's not a good sign. We'll talk more about this with Russell because... Just imagine if you're, well, my teaching moment here. When you teach, I think Kevin does this too. Bring everything down to the individual level. Imagine you are a market maker and you're making a market in say the SPY, which is the S&P 500 ETF. If somebody comes in and wants to buy some puts for your calls, but generally puts are more, it gets more dangerous. Somebody wants to buy. Kevin, you make a market. What are you? Where? Well, Spider is at 671. 660 puts, where are you? And you go, all right, 3 to a quarter. All right, I'll buy 10. The next guy comes in, 660 puts, where are you? 3 to a quarter, I'll buy 20. And you go, all right. Well, the next guy, you're an eighth, three eighths. Hoping to hell the guy sells them to you an eighth, but he doesn't. He buys them up more at three eighths. Now all of a sudden you're a quarter, a half. And you're dying to scratch the first one you sold at a quarter. If you get those back at a quarter, it makes your day because now you're starting to get worried. Well, then the next guy comes in and he's a buyer at 5/8. Then they get under a buy at 3/4. Then they're a buy at even. And all of a sudden you're sitting there going, I'm short. You know, whatever. I'm actually bearish and I'm short, you know, 200 puts all of a sudden, which makes me bullish as all get out in my position. So you might even be half bid at that point, or you're scrambling to sell the futures or you're doing something. You're trying to buy another put off the board. You're trying to sell calls. At this point, you're scrambling. Well, at some point, you have a limit, or your clearing firm has a limit. If you got $1 million in your account, you might say, I can only be short 300 puts. That's it. When you get to 300, it's just over, man. And that's why the VIX is not... People chart the VIX as if it's a stack. There's always more IBM to sell, right? There's always somebody that owns it, and if it's trading up $100, he might look at his screen and decide to sell it up $100, saying, "How the hell did I get that price?" But puts and calls they're not the same way. I mean, there's no natural put sellers. And all of a sudden, if somebody comes in and says, "I can't sell anymore," well, they can go from. It might take 20 brokers to come in and go from $3 to $4. It might take 2 brokers to go from 4 to 6. It's not. Like a regular stock. So you cannot just chart the thing and say, wow, up here there's a sale. They might be, Kevin, but it's the second derivative of the curve. It's not a stock. It's not a future. It is a product that's based on the value of the second derivative, not the first. So you have to be real careful. When you see VIX move up like that, it means that people are kind of close to being saturated. You know, and probably it'll come back down, which it did, which it always seems to. If it gets to 30 or 35, which we've seen a few times, you and I were on the show, it's probably a sale, operative word being probably. Because if it's not, it can go from 35 to 70 in a nanosecond. That's why you see people, once in a while, if they think the market looks squirrely, they'll buy, you know, 10,000 of the 70 calls or something in the VIX. And you sit there going, well, how can it ever get to 70? It could. 87 crash, you got to 300. The guy who knows more about it than anybody is Russell, has written a book about it. And I guarantee you, 99% of the people who trade the VIX have never read the book, Kevin. Go figure, huh?
Ain't that the truth? Go figure.
But in order to understand a lot of this stuff, I think you have to bring it down to the individual level. How many puts are you going to sell? I can only sell 100. I just sold 120. I'm already over my limit. Sorry. You know, because individual people, the market starts to tank. You're not going to have 100 people making markets, which aren't even that many. They're not going to insure the world. That's why those credit default swaps were so bizarre. When people would actually take insurance out on, like, the country of Italy or something. How could Goldman Sachs insure a country, for God's sake? But they did, or tried to, right?
How'd that work out?
Then we're also hot, you know. But, people sell it, and they think they're getting the right price and whatever. So, anyway, all kinds of winners.
Speaking of some of the volatilities, what did oil prices do yesterday?
They're up some this morning, but they're nowheresville. I mean, they're under. They might have cracked.
Yesterday, it took a big jump during the day here.
Okay, but I don't know what happened to that. But your oil is up $1.20 today, which is 2%, but it's still 58.44, still under 60. Our Bob is up 2 cents. It's at 185. So our Bob under $2 is cheap. Our Bob, by the way, is the unleaded gas in New York Harbor or something like that. So that's your wholesale price of gasoline in New York Harbor is our Bob. And that's $1.85. You know, we fill up the chart here, Kevin. You know, we've had gas going up and down 20 and 30 cents by the week here as well. Does it have to do with something in a refinery in Whiting or something? I think it's a local phenomenon.
Well, there's also always the winter and summer changeovers, but that happens with that, you know, with those refineries in general. But and that will spike things, but I think we're past that, you know, changing the blend. Or maybe we're just getting to the fall blend changeover now.
Well, I don't know, but that should make it easier.
That always makes it spike for a week or two.
Well, I think the actual hard part is the summer. The summer piece, because you were the one who was telling us that how many winter blends there are based on the city. There's like 20 of them, right? It's not one. Chicago's got a different one than Minnesota. But I think Chicago, the only ones that do it are Whiting, the guys in along the Illinois River there. What the hell's the name of that place? There's only like three refineries that do the Chicago blend. And that's why it can spike if you have a problem in any one of those places. But I think now, if you've got, I'm not positive on this, I think now, if gas is higher in Chicago than it is in Wisconsin, the guy can just drive down here in the wintertime, can't he? I got our Bob at 219 on August 23rd. And now it's 185, so it's down. God, it's down 30-some cents. That's kind of bad. That's a lot. Now, that's where the truck driver is buying it, okay? It's not where the gas station's buying it. There's a basis to it. You got to get it to the gas station. But it's kind of chopped around all year between, like, 195 and 230. And now this is by far the low at 185. So, but then again, that's New York Harbor, not here. But so there. Not what that told you, but I mean, every time this oil looks like it's going to break out, was it 3 weeks ago? We were talking about it got to 65. And I said, it looks like a breakout. Well, I'm wrong again, huh? Now it's went down to what, 56? That's cheap for oil. I mean, let me see if I can find where the oil chart here. But anyhow, that's where. I don't know what the story is with that. I mean, we got the Russians supposedly selling. I think, Kevin, even though my elves tell me that a good chemist can plunk a needle into the oil in any tanker, and within a little bit of time can tell you exactly where it came from. You know, I wonder if oil from Russia to someplace to somebody, how much of some of that made it to New Orleans or down there, if anybody actually checks. I mean, they probably do, but... And what do you do if it find out it came from somewhere else, or you mixed in with something else? I don't know. I mean, how police do you think it is?
I would just be guessing. I don't know what to tell you about that, other than, if you are going to do sanctions, then they only work if you enforce them. So, our president is enough of a bastard to make sure they get enforced when he wants to do it.
Well,
it depends on his mindset, but he's sort of got in a way that where Michael Corleone says you can't fool a Corleone, so you can't fool a Trump. So.
Well, I don't know about that, but a lot of it is dedication, and plus there's for years. Again, I maybe stepping out a little here. It was illegal for the U.S. to export oil. I think we could export the finished product. We couldn't export oil. Yet, I think, Kevin, for decades, the stuff that came off the North Slope, essentially to Alaska, that's our oil, right? Well, the Japanese were importing oil from Saudi Arabia. Well, guess what? Makes a hell of a lot more sense to ship the stuff from Prudhoe Bay to Japan and the stuff from Saudi Arabia to here. So I think what they did, there was some kind of a swap arrangement where it wasn't really an export, it was a trade of some kind. I think it was some, which to me makes perfect sense. I mean, why would you want the Saudi stuff, going to our West Coast or Japan, and our stuff going through you're never going to get a tanker through the Panama Canal to the Gulf to be refined. So I mean, I think there's always been sort of trade-offs in this stuff, but I don't know. By the time the Russian oil gets to India or gets to China or someplace, did you see the story that Lou sent out about them changing the oil from one tanker to another on the high seas? Good Lord, I wouldn't want to be part of that, would you? It has to be about... I've seen films of ships in the... even though we have nuclear aircraft carriers, you still need tankers with them. Because the planes are not nuclear, right? You need airplane fuel. The pictures of those guys pumping oil from one to the other on the ocean is really something. I can't imagine what a tanker would look like, would you? Well, you better be in some quiet cove or boy.
Yeah, that would be most interesting. Speaking of that, yeah, when you're talking about transportation modes, and you're absolutely right across land yesterday when you mentioned that rail is the cheapest. Yeah, it is. It is absolutely the cheapest.
Well, barges are cheaper if you happen to be on a river, but...
Well, cargo ships are the cheapest, but of course you're not going to have trains across the ocean anyway, so it's not. It's kind of a moot point of the intermodal on that one. The thing that's really cheap once it's up and running is pipeline.
Oh yeah. Well, you can put. You see those barges that go down the Illinois River to Mississippi? God, Kevin, I don't know how those people. There's like 12 barges. The guys. Or more that the dudes are running, and they got to be good at what they're doing, boy. I mean, there's some spots in some of the rivers, there's only like 6 feet of clearance each side of a bridge when you're running a barge through there. Not a barge, 12 of them. It's fascinating. I mean, isn't it? Is there any industry that isn't fascinating when you really dig into it?
Oh, heck, even you could even take stupid things like making cardboard boxes and such.
Oh, don't get me started. I worked for a cardboard box place for a week and quit. I could not handle it. It is so damn dangerous. Cutting that stuff and the guys that were on the line, it was so hot that they used to have everybody be sitting having salt tablets every couple hours. Everybody's sweating so bad. It was brutal. And I was working
most
this.
Most places have gotten better at temperature controls. One is because they really, really don't like killing their employees.
Let's just say the employees there were mostly Hispanic. This was 50 years ago. I don't think they cared. I was running a machine, a bandsaw. You know, now where you've got the things you put on your wrist so you can't get your fingers near the thing when it's moving. They didn't have anything like that. And the band would break like a couple of times a shift. When it broke, it'd go flying past your head. And the guy said, "Hey, you're not doing it right." I go, "What are you talking about?" Anyway, so after a week of this, I go, "See ya." I think I was making $2.50 an hour. It was not worth it.
So just you're saying when Deadliest Catch is out of season, then you could go to the box factory.
Yeah, I mean, you end up with these massive rolls of paper, and you essentially corrugate it, and you put hot glue in there to keep it together, and you essentially make cardboard out of regular paper. It's bizarre. A lot of money in that business. I mean, it doesn't look like much, but there's a huge money in any of that stuff. The packaging for McDonald's, the little boxes the Big Macs come in. If you know how to do that, lady upstairs from me is an engineer in that business. They make a fortune by selling these things at half a cent a piece or something at McDonald's. But I mean, you have to be really good at it. You got to be on time. You know, it's
not always easy to become an approved vendor too.
Oh God, no.
Approved vendor for a company like McDonald's, you're in. You're good to go. And there's, you know, when you start thinking of, a lot of the times packaging is not significant. I think McDonald's looks at it as a marketing tool, especially when you get into things like the Happy Meals and stuff like that. But when you start looking at the packaging, say, for a high-end cell phone, whether it's an iPhone or a Samsung Galaxy, you know, it's more than just putting it in a box. There's a whole presentation to it. That is very important to them, because if they're going to hit you up for $1,100-$1,200 for a cell phone, they want it to look really, really pretty.
Well, one would hope. This is America, right? That it leaks looks like for $1,200.
Yeah, but if you go buy a burner, that's in a little, like plastic package.
How would you know that?
Because I see them in the stores all the time.
Oh, I thought maybe you had like three or four of them.
I have a hard enough time managing one phone number.
I was thinking of getting a burner just to say I had one. I don't know who I'd call with it. They wouldn't know it was me, but I'd find somebody.
Well, I did. You know, I was driving to Nashville about a year ago, and my cell phone conked out, and I didn't know why, because I had it plugged in the whole time I was riding it. Now it turned out I had a bad charging cable, so it was not charging at all, and it was just using. So I stopped at a gas station as soon as I lost it, because I needed the maps. I needed the navigation tool.
And well, you could have walked into the gas station and asked for a map.
Well, I could have done that, or I could have gotten a burner phone to get me through the trip. But the first thing I did was I got went into my luggage and got another charger. And plugged it in, and that was fine. All of a sudden, it took my phone about 5 minutes to become useful again on the charger.
Well, it is. I get abuse from my peers, as we say, because I actually have a second phone, and my carrier, I'm really using Consumer Cellular or something, for the extra number and the extra line, or for the extra, it's $6 a month. And I got this really nice little flip phone that actually does, I guess you could do a little internet. I've never done it. It's $6. So if ever I lose if anybody ever stole or I got mugged or something, I got it in my bag. And I don't know why everybody doesn't do that. I mean, it's not to mention if you're dumb enough to lose your phone in your house, you can call yourself, right?
I could put a burner onto my Google Voice thing and it'll ring it just like it's my regular cell phone.
What does an actual burner cost? Then you buy the cards that gives you the more minutes, right?
Yeah.
But they can't be more than $50. Then you got to buy the minutes.
If that, let me pull it up.
But, hey, so what, where, I saw the Irish didn't move. They're still in the 12th spot. What, there's an awful lot of teams with 0-1, 1 loss ahead of them. The next few weeks should be interesting.
Yeah, they all have to pay each other, play each other, so yeah.
What, is there other than Ohio State?
You're going to go into a lot of games where both teams have one loss, somebody's coming out with two. So, hey, a track phone, a little flip phone, a prepaid smartphone on Amazon is $30.
Where, it seems like every school is having some, I'll use the term growing pains, growing into what, I don't know exactly. And it's the new genre, the name, image, and likeness. The paper, plus it's gone way beyond that. It's just paying people to play, professional. Everybody seems to have had a hiccup, all the traditional powers, kind of except Ohio State. How are they managing to transfer into this new world without missing a beat?
Well, they lose people, but they get them. You know, so, Joe Burrow, the Cincinnati quarterback, he left Ohio State for LSU. And they replaced him, I believe, with Justin Fields, who transferred in from Georgia.
But, I mean, Alabama...
Because Ohio State recruits well. They get people out of high school, and they do well on that. But they also... They lose them as fast as they get them, just like Alabama does, but they replace them very, very quickly.
Well, Alabama seems to be, I mean, they're still good, but they're not total top tier like they were before. And the only one that seems to be, if I had a name, and if it wasn't for Ohio State in number one slot, I'd say the national championship's up for grabs, but those guys still are better than everybody else, aren't they, by a long way? Seems to be, anyway.
Well, they're deep. You know, everybody gets injuries. They withstand them a little bit better because they have depth. And then those guys leave and they bring in new depth.
Well, you end up having to play, four extra games. If you're the Irish, if you're not in the top four slots, you need four games after the season's over, right? So that's 16 games. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot for that age group because they're not fully developed physically yet.
Well, how many, when you look at a pro team, obviously those guys, I think, are having a problem with the 17 games, and now the geniuses want to go to 18, right? But you look at the pro teams, they have, 45, I used to know this, the 45 guys suit up, and there's, 10 guys in the practice squad, something like that. So they have a pool of, roughly 55 people that are professional football players that theoretically they're not as good as the first string, but they can all play, you would hope. Out of the 85 people that are in scholarship at, say, Notre Dame or Indiana or someplace, how many of those people can actually play in a big-time game, Kevin? It can't be two-thirds of them. It's got to be way less than that. I mean, when I say play, you can put somebody out there, but how many guys are just there because, they didn't grow or didn't do this, they're practice players, basically. I don't know that those... A 16-game season for a team like that, is a... That's a long haul.
Yeah, it depends a lot on the position, too. For example, it's unusual that Notre Dame has two backs that are as good as Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price. And that they both could be in the pros next year, because by now... At most places, Price would have been gone 2 years ago because he's playing behind Love. And, Jadarian Price, he's a genuine pro prospect. Somebody's going to get Notre Dame's number two running back, in the draft next year, and they're going to get a real gem. That's unusual. Most people are going to leave earlier than that. And then you get down to some very talented younger guys, but are they that developed? But you also get, it depends. Notre Dame lost its best offensive lineman early, before the season started, and it took them a couple of games, but they haven't missed a beat. But then last week they lost their starting center for the season, and the new guy came in and he didn't miss a beat. He was great. Like I said, they just pushed you know, from a rushing standpoint, they pushed USC around the field.
How bad is that? Their all-world guard, is he okay?
The guy that was so good last week. Who was?
But the game has changed to a certain extent. I mean, if you were Southern Cal behind O.J. Simpson, the guy carried the ball 35 times a game. He never came out. So if you were a second-string backup, you're doing second-string backup, Department of Redundancy Department. You might have got two carries a game in mop-up duty. But now, nobody carries the ball. I mean, if you're going to rush 35 times, you're going to have two backs. And they're all going to, you know, they're going to... Your second-string back's going to get the ball 15 times, or 12, or something. It's not like it was. I mean, we're you know, the guy played every single. I mean, Jim Brown never came out of a game, right?
Walter Payton never came out of a game.
Yeah. So I mean, there were people behind him who were capable. That once in a while would come in, you know, if the game was already over, and they weren't bad. But yeah, in those days you would have had to leave. But now, I think Price is happy with what he's getting there. He's getting enough carries. He's getting some kickoff returns. He's not getting the crap beat out of him. You know,
and if you look at it that way too, because there's only so much mileage you have in you as a football player. The idea that you know, you can preserve some of that, preserve your legs a little bit, and that could become part of that can become, you know, something that extends your pro career. Then, you know, maybe you got something there.
Well, the guy who was, I really thought he would be, you know, I'm talking Hall of Fame talent, was the guard the Bears got. What's his name? Howie Long's kid.
I thought
he was that good. And he only played, what the hell did he play? Did he play baseball or something? He didn't play in college until he was a senior? Or maybe a junior? And I thought, holy...
He was playing baseball for a while.
Yeah, I'm sitting there, holy crap, oh, this guy... If he's only got 2 years of football on those legs, he could play 15 years, and all of a sudden he had somebody fell on his leg and totally messed up his ankle and never really healed right. I mean, you know, stuff can still happen, but I thought that guy was going to be a 15-year all-pro. That didn't work out, you know. Plus, the Bears are so idiotic. He was an all-world guard, and because they didn't have a tackle, they moved him to tackle, and he was a above-average tackle, but he wasn't all-pro like he was as a guard, I didn't think. Of course, the Bears do those kinds of things. Hey, so what's going on
Before we get away from it, too, I talked about pushing Southern California around the field. They rushed for 306 yards. You know, Jeremiah Love had 228, Price had 87, and a 100-yard kickoff return. I'm a Neanderthal when it comes to football. If you can run like that, I love watching it.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, those guys, all they need is a hole, and they're gone. I mean, it's... Jeremiah Love almost, he doesn't have quite the individual kind of moves, but he almost looks like a Gale Sayers to me, that guy.
Oh, he's got good moves, I think. I think he makes some real moves.
Well, what I'm saying is Sayers had that odd way where he would lock his heel into the ground and just stop on a dime. I don't think I've ever seen anybody do that. But yeah. In today's world...
There's also a famous clip out there of Gale Sayers looking into the camera and saying, give me 18 inches of daylight, that's all I need.
Yep. But, I mean, I think that he would have run out of his own leg on some of these artificial fields. His leg would have stuck.
Well, certainly in the interim, you know, the current generation gives way some.
Yeah.
There was a whole generation of artificial turf fields that would have been really, really hard on him.
What's the... I'm surprised we're getting the CPI report this week, Kevin, but evidently we are. What's the employment situation down by you? Here, it seems like people are struggling to get jobs. It's hard to tell. I mean, I'm not interviewing and things like that, but it seems like it's not as easy as it was. That's what people are saying. And most of the gains are still in healthcare. And your area, when you're a lot, so much of the distribution is coming there, you got to have your finger on the pulse of the economy. Are people dying to hire, or just hanging in there, or laying people off?
Stable, kind of status quo. There's jobs to get, but it's not like everybody is begging and saying, geez, I can't find anybody.
All right. Hey, I want to show this to you. I dug this out. We talk all the time around about the CPI being, you know, basically a lie for 30-some years of presidents. They all seem to be on board with this. And I think, you know, one of the ones we always pull out, Kevin, is the medical care. I actually found they're doing this out of the Fed, or maybe I just found it or whatever. You can actually go line by line in the CPI, and they'll go back and give you the history of that line. So I dug up yesterday the medical care. Now this, my biggest bitch here is that the medical care is 6.7, they're up to, percent of the basket, when nationwide it's 20% of the economy, and individual people that I know, especially people that are older, it could be 50% of their basket, right? I mean, easily. As a matter of fact, I have one of my friends, I was going through the stuff with him, a guy works in the building, and Kevin, the dude's got, he's getting Social Security, so he's like $2,600, which he gets Social Security. And now, actually Social Security is like $2,800, but you're paying $200, they don't give you, that's actually your Medicare Part A. So when people get their Social Security check, the Part A has already been taken out of it. Let's say $200 a month for that. So then, his supplemental is $335 a month. All right, so now we're up to $535. The drug piece is another $60, so we're up to $600. And he has his doctor is one of those concierge doctors, so that's like $100 a month or $200 a month. And he's on a couple of drugs, the main one being the Eliquis that I always talk about. His contribution to that last year was $300 a month. So we're up to, where are we? $800? $850? Out of $2,600, that's a little more than 20%, don't you think? And if he has any kind of copay anywhere, or any sort of other drug, you know, he could be at $1,000 out of 1,700 out of 2,700. So I mean, it's a real big deal. But anyway, this chart gives that particular piece, and from January of they give you with the running number here from January 2000. It was 255.6. In July of 2025, they don't have, for some reason, the August number in here, it's 584.7. So that's up 130%, really. And the CPI is up 90% in that same 25 years. So it's almost 50% more. That's if you believe their numbers. It's almost 50% more than the average CPI. So if you were to nudge that 6.5 up to the 20 where it ought to be, I'm going to say your CPI has got to be at least 1% higher a year, wouldn't you? Which, if you did that, in most of the years since 2000, we're probably not even positive on real growth, are we? And if you added the owner's equivalent rent in there, which is another fictional one, so if the two of them added 1.5% a year, which I think they easily would do, maybe 2%, you got no growth. That's how close we are to the line here, so 2000. It's how many different presidents? Five, six. I mean, it almost doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, obviously, different presidents have different styles and different capabilities, if any, on some of these guys. But when you look at these charts that go back, you know, 10, 20 years, it's almost like you can't even tell when one guy got in and when the other guy left. It's a whole different world if you just look at that and just blot out the personalities. It's like nothing ever changes, Kevin. It's crazy.
Well, it's interesting, as you raise it, is you have to wonder how much our presidents really set in policy. Some are economic policy, aren't, but a lot of other policies they do, or policies that come out of the administration. So, like in the case of the Biden administration, I don't think he was setting much policy at all. In fact, I think he was surprised by some of the things that came out. I forget, it might have been Speaker Johnson that asked him about the why he blocked natural gas exports, and he said, "I didn't do that." Yes, you did.
Well, I mean, I think if you were to ask any of these people, I mean, the two biggest things that I look at, and because this is just my, well, now there's all kinds of other stuff going on, which I don't want to get into, you know, with what's going on here in Chicago, but my biggest bitch is really since the 80s, you got to keep an eye on inflation. You got to keep an eye on monetary growth, because that buries people, because I saw it happen once and I thought I'd never see it again, and yet I have for like three presidents full now, or four. So that's a problem. And you look at the medical stuff, and whatever's happening, and I, you know, we could take individual policies, you know, Biden's approach, the Democrats' approach, Trump's approach, and to me, they all suck. They take one side or the other, and none of them come anywhere close to addressing the problem, which is the costs are way too high, and as a result, a lot of people are opting out, and they don't have any insurance, and they're not going to a doctor. So that's absolutely not the result I'm looking for, but I don't see the Democratic solution or the Republican solution as being a solution. I don't know what it even is. So, I mean, when you look at those kinds of things, I don't see either party even addressing any of this stuff coming. I mean, I just don't. I mean, I don't see the constant back and forth, both parties going, you know, this for the middle class, this for the middle class. The fact is, nobody's done anything for the middle class except shrink it. I mean, it is, you know, the Democratic solution. Well, I don't know if they've had a solution, but for somebody, I see in my industry, we've combined thousands of people who used to make markets in the market to five or six firms. And if you're going to work in this industry, you're going to work for one of those people. Well, that sucks. And you know, even the brokerage industry. When we started, you could be a small broker, you could do real well. I mean, we're doing okay, but boy, it's a struggle. I mean, every single policy is directed towards big people, this and that. Even your audits. You know, a small firm has to have a massive audit. For what? For what? We had three audits this year. Now, I guess if you're Merrill Lynch, you put the audit guys over there and you let them play with the people, it's okay. But
because if you're Merrill Lynch, you can afford a big audit staff.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't, at anything that...
it's disruptive to your business while they're there, while they're auditing you.
Yeah, anything that could possibly be messing with the middle class. I mean, yesterday I was at a kind of a debate with Hal, and he's talking about Trump bringing people in from overseas and making investments here. I have nothing against that. Nothing against that at all. But I want our normal ways of doing business. Guys like you and me, Kevin, saying, holy crap, we're missing, somebody's missing this product. If we had this product, this industry would work better. You and I having an idea, getting a couple of people to back us, getting a loan, putting a building up, having some sign of certainty that this is the way things are going to be for the next 10 or 15 years. Well, there's never total certainty, but some kind of certainty. I don't think that has happened in either one of the last administrations. I don't think what Trump's doing, it makes people almost less likely, because he changes his mind every day, to go do something like that. The Democrats, I don't even know if they have a policy towards it. So I don't know. I don't know where we are. I mean, I don't see any. I mean, we're not shipping soybeans to China. You would think that somebody would have a policy without letting people go broke and have other people buying up their farms and all the other kind of crap that people are doing. Instead of saying, okay, anybody above this, what do you call it? We're gonna rebate, or we're gonna give somebody a loan for a dollar and a half a bushel, which is the difference in cost between getting it to Portland and getting it to New Orleans. Something simple like that that somebody anticipates and just does, Kevin. I don't see any of that, Democrat, Republican, any place, do you? I don't see anybody with any sort of solving any problems of any real kind to anybody. I don't know why. Maybe I'm being sour on this stuff, but we're late with them. I see that as those guys are going to lose their farms, other people are going to buy them, and 2 years from now, the check will arrive and the new guy gets it. I mean, is that intentional, or is it just... I'm beginning to think it's intentional. It's not just a mistake. Just saying. Are you there? You're not there. We lose Kevin? Yeah, I'm saying, I mean, I don't even know how to... It's topic after topic, administration after administration. Is it just everybody so greedy to get something on their own that... at the end of the day, everybody's just sitting there going, what happened?
Well, I think there's so much going on that, you know, you're almost playing a policy whack-a-mole, too. So, you just run from one thing to the next.
But it always seems like the same people end up okay, doesn't it?
Oh, that's true.
I mean, this student loan forgiveness thing, is that going to help anybody? The one that just came out yesterday? I didn't get a chance to go through it.
I didn't get a chance to look at it, so I don't know.
Must be going to help somebody, or else it wouldn't... It's some kind of a program. What do you make of all that? I mean, do you think we should allow some people to be able to declare bankruptcy, at least if you're disabled or something? I mean, for God's sake.
Don't know what to tell you. The way the current law is, you have, you know, some excuses. So you have to deal with that. I have to look at it and see what it does.
What's the...
I work at a place where, like, you know, 88% of the people come out with no debt. So,
what does the? I was going to say, you guys, I won't say dodge that. You charge a price at which people can pay. That's not dodging. That's addressing it straight up. Is the way I see it.
It is, and there's a lot of grant money available for people too. So,
where does that mostly come from?
State. There is some federal stuff too. I mean, certainly VA. We have a lot of veterans, but you also, the state of Indiana has something called the Workforce Ready Grant, and they have a series of chosen fields of study that they want to nurture. All you have to be is a high school graduate. Don't have another college degree, because you're not eligible once you have a college degree. But that is... that is focused on things like business, IT, logistics and supply chain, robotics and advanced automation, advanced manufacturing, and construction and healthcare. Those students can go to school basically if you're a resident of the state of Indiana who has the legal right to work in the state, then you are eligible for the grant. And
well, Kevin, what's the difference between, it's more kind of over time here, but that's, what's the difference between if I want to do my first 2 years of, say, engineering there or finance or accounting with the intention of going to IU and I'm taking pretty much a full-time load, what's the difference between that and somebody who's maybe working at an auto repair shop and they say, go get your brake certification or your, you know, whatever, because you can, some other kind of certification. It might be a 12-week course. What does something like that cost? What does the other stuff cost?
Usually the employer is going to pay for that, and the employer can go get grants as well.
But, I mean, is it 500 bucks, 1,000 bucks?
To develop the skills of their employees.
But what's when we're talking 10,000 bucks, 1,000 bucks for a 12-week course or something?
Couldn't tell you.
But the full load is probably, what, half of IU or half of Purdue or something, or is it less than that? Somebody taking his first 2 years of engineering, say.
Engineering at my place?
Yeah.
Well, they're probably paying, it's starting to crowd up to $400 a course, but that includes everything, including all your books and so on. Hey, Russell, what's the per credit hour? I was going to say 400, but it's per credit hour, so it's,
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's something like 108 something per credit hour for us. Have the IU credit hour charges?
I honestly have no idea. Okay. It's just something I'm not really involved in. I can tell you how much it costs to go to Purdue before I can tell you how much it costs to go to IU, just because I'm paying for somebody to go there. But I'm terrible with that stuff. I teach in five different programs. I have a hell of a time keeping up with, you know, what the next classes are for the people that I teach to.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, if 88% of the people...
It's funny because I've talked to them about getting into administration and stuff. And they're like, look, we've just really, you know, think the best stuff you can do for us is be in the classroom. So I, you know, that's kind of what I focus in on.
Well, if 88% of the people come out with no loans, it must be fairly affordable. It has to be. Right, Kevin?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it has to be.
Yeah, over it.
We have, my typical student has a job and a family and school. At least 2 out of 3.
Yeah.
Well,
and it makes them great, you know. I mean, they really are fantastic because of that, because they juggle so much. It's not like when I went away to Notre Dame and the only thing I had to worry about was being a student, at least until, you know, I did get part-time jobs my last couple of years.
Well, I'll say this. My when I was at the University of Chicago and I was going daytime and I had just come out of undergrad, you know, and did pretty well and everything was fresh. And I drive over, I take a class, I go play ball for a couple hours, take another class, go home, had plenty of time to study. It was almost kind of it was so much easier than I see these people going at night. And, you know, everything you do, you experience, I think you sort of remember. It's all part of the, whatever, the file cabinet up in your brain. I ended up taking 2 courses at night in the summer. I tell you, nothing gave me more respect for people to go to night school after working all day for me taking those 2 courses. I mean, even though I was a janitor at Chicago Public Schools and I'd do my stuff and I had plenty of time to study it at work, if that's what you want to call it, still, sitting there from 6 to 9 at night in a non-air-conditioned room, I was dying. I can't imagine what it would have been like to actually had like a worked all day in a law office, or you wouldn't be going to law school. Maybe you were working all day and then going home to you know, with the kids and all the other stuff for like 3 and 4 years versus 1 summer. I mean, I have nothing but respect for people who do that, who did that, or still are doing it. I mean, it's such a different world.
My students is you know, they are really. They're driven, and you know, it's sometimes you got to give them some grace when it comes to that. Nobody gets a break, but anybody gets some grace because life's going to get in the way of school sometimes.
I mean, it's people really want to do that stuff. I mean, your hat is just off to them. It really, really is. I mean, most of your guys, well, it's hard to say, Kevin. You have all different kinds. You got night and you got day, right?
Yeah.
Do you guys have it IU, what's the name of the business school again? Do you have an executive program, Russell?
Yeah, I was Executive Education Teacher of the Year.
Nice.
Really?
Yes, we do have an executive education program.
I think the guys who used to teach my stepfather went to...
So I haven't gotten my trophy then.
Oh, yeah, when my stepfather went to University of Chicago, it must have been one of the first years they even tried it. I think University of Chicago was like first. And I think to be the Executive Teacher of the Year... You had to go out every Friday night and drink with all the students.
No, that's not me.
No, but I mean, these guys did every Friday, right to Martinis for Martinis. The whole class.
No, jump off, you guys. I have a doctor's appointment shortly.
All right, so, but hey, good luck with that. Come back healthy.
I'll try.
All right.
See ya.
No, our executive education stuff. We've been doing that since the 70s.
Yeah, that's about when he started. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, the Kelly Direct thing, we were kind of very, very early on with the online stuff. So that's why I'm an attractive teacher for them, because I, you know, did so much online work when I was at SIBO that, you know, I like to tell people I think I'm better online than I am when I'm teaching in the classroom.
Does anybody still have satellite locations, or are they the way the dodo bird?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got, I mean, IU has campuses all over the state, IU Indy is kind of, or Kelly in Indianapolis, where my office is kind of like a satellite of Bloomington. You know, Notre Dame did that with the campus they had on Michigan Avenue. I don't know if they still do that or not.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They used to... Kathy McGrath.
Yeah, we totally do that.
Well, Kathy McGrath's sister.
You know what? I'll tell you what's very fascinating to me. The number of universities, since you kind of went down this path, the number of universities that have satellite campuses in Washington, D.C.
Really?
Yeah, I'll be walking around with Maggie, and we'll suddenly walk by the University of Southern California's Washington, D.C. campus. there are a lot of very major universities that'll have like small, you know, small programs that you go and stay in the nation's capital for a year.
Well, the what I was referring to, and I don't know if they have these anymore, is Notre Dame had one here. I don't know, it was in Schaumburg or whatever, but you went to campus for like 2 weeks to start your first year of the MBA program or something. Maybe it was a week.
Oh, we do that. We have them go to Bloomington for a week, but for our online students.
Well, see, but these
we have
these they,
we have
this a, before online, they would actually have in a, yeah. in a strip mall. One of the stores would be the Notre Dame MBA program that would hold, you know, 40 people. It would mm-hmm. be like Hollywood Squares. You go in there and, you know, it was set up like that. But you didn't do it from home. You had to go to the place every night.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say satellite camp, it really wasn't a campus. It was like a satellite, whatever you want to call it, storefront. I don't know if they'd ever tell you that weirdo story. We used to have a lady that worked here before she got her grad degree at DePaul and started teaching there, online marketing and stuff. Brilliant lady. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, she left us because we couldn't match that salary. But she used to Google. I never do this to myself. Some people do every day. She used to Google my name all the time. This is when, you know, we were traveling around the country and doing seminars and everything. All of a sudden, my name pops out. This is after the 2007 crash. Pops out, and my name is on an exam at Notre Dame's MBA school, of all places. And we were doing the show. I mean, I think I was on with Dr. J on the score.
Uh-huh.
And or maybe it was something I wrote, because I used to write a column back then. And it was something about when people were buying puts in Bear Stearns, when the stock was still trading 32, like that Thursday morning, and people were buying the 10 puts for Friday night. I said, you know mm-hmm. what? Somebody knew something that other people didn't know, because nobody just for yucks buys the 10 puts when a stock's trading 35 with 8 hours left of trading to go. I mean, right?
I have a different opinion on that. Well, I think they bought the puts and they forced it.
Well, I mean, if it was worth anything, it would have come back. But anyway, I'm saying...
I think when I say forced it, you know, one of Bear Stearns' biggest businesses back then was being the main, you know, the prime broker, which some people know what that is, some people don't, but the main broker for a lot of hedge funds, and it was a big part of their business. And the hedge funds started pulling their money out of Bear Stearns and buying put options at the same time, because that's who kind of knew. But then at the same time, they're taking actions that was pushing them in the wrong direction.
But I'm saying there were people normally mm-hmm. when they just came out with earnings like not that far before that they still were a going concern. I mean, we're pushing Wednesday here, and I got Caterpillar trading 526, first one to pop. If all of a sudden everybody started buying the 75 puts and Friday afternoon it was worth zero, I'd say those guys had heads up on something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be. Actually, you know, this is going to sound weird, Russell. You know, we had a heads up on it. It was me.
Who?
Me.
Did you?
Well, I mean, tell me if this was a heads up. We have a client, still do. He was in one of the big off balance sheet Bear Stearns. They had all the stuff off balance sheet. They were like Enron, right? So he's one of these off balance sheet investments, and I'm going to say 6 months before any of this happened, he dropped seven figures there. The thing went bust.
Yeah.
And this was 6 months before anything happened. Before anything hit the news, other than plus it wasn't on their balance sheet, so it wasn't even attributable to them. You know, nobody said.
Yeah, it was like it's almost like they were running a side hedge fund.
Yeah, and so that went out. I guess I should have said.
But went belly up.
But if I would have said, "Oh my God, look in the mirror, hey Chief, you better start buying puts in Bear Stearns." If I had started buying them that day, mm-hmm. I wouldn't have made anything. My whole chuck box would have been gone. And then all of a sudden, 6 months later, you know, I think I might have said this on air one time. John and I used to do. Remember a guy named Benji Schwartz? His dad was his dad owned a clearing firm at the CME. He's a character, nice guy. There was this other guy, Goran something, this Armenian guy. Well, the four of us, we did a So this was the predecessor to the show on CNBC, Traders on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So we were Traders on TV and this cable station, and every Thursday night we'd go over to the Weigel Broadcasting over in Halsted, and the four of us would sit there, and this one guy, Goran, I can't remember his name, big, tall, good-looking guy, and boy, he had a gorgeous wife. He had all his family money. His dad was a big builder, and he managed all the family money. And he was, I think the stock was, it was United Healthcare? No, it was one of those things, one of those big healthcare companies. And uh-huh. He was absolutely convinced that he had some information that this place was going under, and that they had some accounting screw-up or something. So the guys, he didn't know how to do options, but he shortened the hell out of it, and all the thing did was go up. And all of a sudden, he blew through his money, he blew through the family's money. I don't know what happened to him. I haven't seen him in, you know, a decade and a half. Russell, it couldn't have been 3 months later. Sure enough, the stock comes out, and they come out with some announcement that somebody was cooking the books. Stock drops by like 3/4 in a day. The guy was early. You know, he just...
Yeah.
He was right all along, but it just, you know... You know, that's the thing, when I used to lecture a long time ago, you still do, I'd say, guys, you know, if you found out, say, that IBM is underpriced, overpriced, or whatever, and you're absolutely convinced, you know, boy, it's trading 282, it's really worth 320 or worth 220, even if you're right, don't expect to buy a call or put it at 9 o'clock and everybody else figure out what you know by noon. You could be like, you know, 2 years early, if you're right.
No, my... That's what, and I've been very, very happily married for almost 24 years now, and years ago, I'll make these big prognostications about the market, and like this thing can't last. I think this is going to catch up with it, and of course I'm walking around the house, and she's the only person that can hear the other side of this, and she said, I have noticed that when you say these things, 6 months later, they come true. And she was dead on with that one.
Did I ever...
So now, whenever I'm really convinced that there's something, I write something in the calendar 6 months in the future.
Well, you know, funny you should mention that. One of our first clients was this guy from... Well, he was originally from Columbus, Indiana. And he had a... He owned, like...
We have a satellite campus in Columbus, Indiana, by the way.
Well, this dude... Also owned. Well, he also.
That's our one big satellite case.
Wow. Well, he actually owned three islands up in the Bay of the Islands in Lake Huron, which is kind of bizarre. He would go back and forth there from Columbus, Indiana, before there was a bridge, Mackinac, and they would take the ferry. And he had to really want to get there.
And
then he ends up going to Arizona, moving down there, becomes this massive developer kind of guy, right? But he was a Merrill Lynch broker in like 1954 or something. Was always interested in the market, always traded. And all of a sudden he starts trading futures. And he goes, okay, you know, I'm kind of retired. He puts $250,000, which was a lot of money back in whenever the hell he started this, 90, 91. Mm-hmm. And he's trading futures. And at the end of the year, he's working his ass off and he's breaking even. And just what you said, he says, you know, he had... Help me with this. There were, and probably still are, like four, if you really dig into technical analysis, there's like four different schools of thought. There's Joe Granville's original, which is pretty good. I think there's the one everybody took on the trading floor, the Fibonacci. Then there's another one where it goes up here and comes down another. What's that one? Not the candlestick or something. Anyway, there's like four of them. I remember the name.
Yeah.
And so he... At that time, gets this computer system, and he gets this feed. I think it was FutureSource was the feed, and he's got all four of these things on four different, you know, screens. And when they all matched up on the same thing, he'd do something, and he'd always put a stop in. He says to me, you know, most of the time, a la Russell, he goes, I'm right, but I'm always early, and I always get stopped out.
Yeah.
And so what he ended up doing, he says, you know, they're all different. So he started to do regression analysis, going back on all his trades and every single one of the commodities. And he found out that there actually was a lag time that was different for every one. Like corn or soybeans, I think it was like 4 days, 5 days. Pork bellies, when he used to trade those, he was like 2 weeks. So he started, whenever the thing told him to buy, he'd wait the 3 or 4 days, or the 5 or 6, whatever, whichever was that particular one. And, you know, gold and silver, all the different stuff that was in there, oil. He had, like, a time frame for all of them. The next year, he goes, he absolutely kicked ass. Because there was a delay that was... He said the one that didn't have a delay was the S&Ps didn't really have a delay. That if it happened, it happened. But he's all the other ones, which is just what you're saying. It's almost like, and I feel the same way for me, if somebody would just keep my hands in the pocket for like 4 months or 5 months or 6 or something,
yeah,
we'd be doing better, Russell. But
And we're closer to it. Although one of the things that Dr. Adimiak and I are working on right now is... the how quickly things change in the markets, because more and more people are paying attention and we've got easier access to information. I do think that the how quickly the market reacts to things has changed, or how quickly information is digested by the market, just because, you know, you got three business networks and then all the brokerage firms telling you everything that's going on all the time as well. Yeah,
and we also have more front running than I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Because
things change so quickly.
Well, every time the president opens his mouth, things change.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a problem. I mean,
yep.
Well, I wanted you. We got time before break, so we don't have to go forever into it. Last Thursday, Friday, when the market had that big down move that came right back the next day, I was surprised and actually, frankly, a little worried, and still am, about how quickly the VIX went from 19 to 25 in one day, which leads me to believe that some of these firms that provide liquidity to the floor are kind of gagging on numbers, on units here.
That they got out of the way very quickly.
Yeah, it makes me a little nervous. What does it do to you?
Well, if you've got a macro position or running a macro fund, you're kind of flying half blind, or, you know, you're in a fight with one hand tied behind your back right now because of the lack of information that we're getting. But that's changing because we're getting ready to get in. We are, you know, entering into earnings season where companies are going to tell us what they think and what's going on. And then I've heard multiple from 2 or 3 different places that we're getting ready to see. Did you say CPI or PPI on Friday?
CPI allegedly is coming out. I think it's coming out.
CPI on Friday. Yeah, I've heard it, it's like you. I heard you say that, and somebody else I heard say that, but I haven't, you know, gone to the Googleator and double checked the number and made sure that's what's going on.
Well, it's scheduled for Friday for sure. I thought we wouldn't get one. To be honest with you, we didn't get a labor number.
I would think we wouldn't get one either, but maybe I'm not going to try to prognosticate on that one. The point is that we're in a period here where there's a lack of information, and there might be a bit more knee-jerk reactions to what the market is doing. I didn't think late last week was it. And, you know, as far as the overdue sell-off that I think is coming, which isn't that a great trader speak way of saying that, man, have I been wrong expecting a sell-off for a while now? Boy, did I twit. I love how I turned that one in my first statement there. But I just feel like we're overdue for it. I'm probably not alone. And if we're in an information vacuum and the market starts to sell off, you got to think that somebody else knows something I don't know, and it becomes a little bit of a snowball effect. So that's what I think was happening late last week. But when the equity markets are doing funny things, I turn to what is the fixed income market doing, and does it look like there's this change in opinion about what needs to happen from the FOMC? And that number didn't budge late last week.
Well, I think
and that made me think this ain't it. I wasn't, you know, piling into my shorts.
You can't even if you feel. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, if I were to scribble with my left hand, I'd say, oh my God, I can't believe how overvalued some of these stocks are by traditional stuff. I mean, we're talking about stacks that are 25, 30 times revenue when 11 to 15 was the death knell in 2000. So, you know, some of these stacks are, not only are they double, some of them are bigger. I mean, we're to the point where if you look at that, you go, oh my God. But then you look at the other side, you see a Fed chair, not only is he on his way out, he's been totally cowered by this president, and where he's doing everything, he's going to stop the runoff of the balance sheet. The new buffoon who's on there is calling for a half a point drop. They're going to pour money in the system, which absolutely does nothing but help the people at the top of the chain, people that own stuff, stocks, and people who own resorts and whatever else. I mean, people can argue with me all day long about other stuff. You can't argue about that one. I mean, that's about as black and white as the day is long. And so if they start pouring money back in here, I don't think, even at these prices, that I want to be all that short for my clients. In other words, you got to be protected, but I think you also got to be in, because if that's what they're going to do, if that's what they're going to do, you know, we could go up a bunch from here, even though all it's going to do is make things even more and more ridiculously priced. But I don't think it matters. If you double the amount of money in a system, guess what? The market's going to double. Duh.
Yeah. And you got to keep dancing.
Yeah. But at the same point.
But, yeah.
I mean, I remember this. This day, our buddy, I was in New York doing something for the SIBO. Of course, John's with me, because he was going to meet some people. And he goes, hey, by the way, I'm supposed to give him this lecture over in Brooklyn, and I've double booked. By the way, it's at 6:30 in the morning. I go, how the hell did you double book at 6:30 in the morning? And he goes, but I did. So, of course, me being the good soldier and good friend, I hop on the subway. This is, you know, this is 19, God knows when, where nobody really went to Brooklyn. I never been there first. I get on the subway at 5 in the morning. It's dark, and over, I end up Brooklyn. I walk up the hotels right there. It's the sourest looking group I've ever seen in my life. This guy starts the lecture. And I'm supposed to be just the market maker guest knucklehead, and he couldn't even get these people to say hello to him. He turns to me and he goes, "I can't handle this crowd. They're all yours," and leaves. This is the guy who's running the seminar. So,
love it.
How was that? And so I get up there and I go, how's everybody doing? And my first New York group, and they're grumpy as all get out. I said, okay, what's everybody doing here? You're supposed to teach repair strategies. And I go, okay, I can do that. We've done those, and I know how to do that. I said, how many people here, what stock are we talking about? And the guy said, well, I got Cisco. I said, how many people here got Cisco? You know, three quarters of the room raised their hand. Now, Cisco had just gone from 66 to 6. And I'm thinking, boy, I'm pretty good on repair strategies, but I don't know if I got one. I got one that good.
There's not one for that.
I said, you might have to. I could teach you a repair strategy to get from maybe 6 to 10, and then if that works, we could do one from 10 to 15. But I said, this is going to be a process, assuming the thing ever goes back to 60, right? I tell you what, and I said, so they're all over me about being a market maker on the floor, and I ruined their stock. And I go, guys, I'm an OEX trader. I said, in anticipation of coming out here, I did some research on these widely held stocks, and I've got Cisco, when it was at 66, the revenue per share is like $5. I go, does anybody here even know that? And they look at me, well, no. I said, well, for God's sake, how does something, the revenue, even if they have 100% margin, which nobody does, they can only make $5 a share.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and really making like 30 cents a share. I mean, what makes you think it was worth $66? And they look at me and they go, that's where it was traded. It was going up every day. Everybody said to buy it. Okay. That's kind of what's sort of happening now, right?
There is now I'm going to. So Thursday in class, somebody asked me, how do you justify NVIDIA's valuation? And I did a cash flow. I did a conservative cash flow model, and I came up with $4 trillion.
Okay.
So, you've talked about, just on the other side of it, NVIDIA ain't that overpriced right now.
Well, it depends on how you, again.
What I'm looking at, I'm not looking at time sales or anything. What I'm looking at is their cash flow has gone up tenfold in the last 5 years.
Okay, that part I get.
So, there is some justification as to where NVIDIA is right now, even if you expect it to, slow down to about 15% growth over the next 5 years.
You know what, the revenue?
I can come. If you expect it to slow down to about 15% growth, and you're demanding a 15% return, you can come up with a $4 trillion valuation.
You know
right
what?
Now.
You know what the revenue per share is?
That's not. I do know it's kind of a silly number, but it's going up almost exponentially. I wouldn't say exponentially, but it's going up tremendously over the next, over the foreseeable future. And then if you just expect it to slow up to like a normal company, you can justify where it is right now.
$650 million.
Yeah.
So what is that? 30 times revenue?
Yeah. But, you know, next year's numbers are expected to be, I don't have them in front of me, but it was like a 50% year-over-year increase from this year to next year.
Well, let's go to break and we'll come back. There's like three caveats to that. By the way, I happen to think NVIDIA might be the winner here, so I'm kind of agreeing with you, but let's go a quick break, because there's things about this stock that make me cautious. Let's put it that way. SP Futures up 3, NASDAQ Futures down 41. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello, and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 5. NASDAQ Futures down 38. It's a little bit of a mixed bag here this morning. Netflix is the big mover, down $96. It's 8%. In fact, still $1,144, but still 8% a move on their earnings yesterday. Over in Europe, we have the DAX down 16. Call that flat. FTSE up 90. That's almost a full percent. CAC around down 21.3%. So, I'd say mixed over there, not much of anything. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 8, call that flat. Hang Seng down 245, they were up, it's a full percent. Shanghai down 2, Shanghai was up pretty much yesterday when you get Russell's view on the China stuff. South Korea, however, continues to hit fresh new highs. Maybe we should start talking about those guys. Bonds, this has been quiet, 3.95, unchanged. The Bund, 2.56, unchanged. Oil, which is, like Kevin mentioned earlier, is rallying. But rallying for such a deep hole, it's up $1.17 to $58.41, still way under to $63. It's been hanging around for like a long time. Brent up $118, $62.50. Gold, which has gotten absolutely torched yesterday, is getting torched again today. On $64, $4,044. It was $4,300 and over, I think, on Friday night. Silver down 33 cents, $47.37. We have puts protecting those positions. I'm wondering if we should roll our puts down and look for the bounce. Play the bounce, buy the dip. I don't know. That's gonna bounce or not. Part of that is because the dollar is at its 3-day rally. Euro was 117 3-4 days ago. Over that, now it's 115.84. Again, we'll get Russell's view on these currency markets and how they affect people. Not necessarily us, we don't think, but sort of do. British pound 133. It was over 135 a few days ago. So, crazy stuff. Crypto down $3,800. 108.068. Yesterday was kind of weird. Gold was down, Bitcoin was down, and then Bitcoin turned around and went up, but now Bitcoin's down again today. So seeming like the regular dollar is strong, and the gold and Bitcoin are taking a hit the last couple days. We'll see if that lasts. Andrew, what do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Oops, there we go. It's 10:22 here in Chicago, and it's Wednesday, October 22nd.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Nothing really exciting for us going on in sports today, Ryan?
Today's kind of big. Well, last night basketball started, so the Bulls play tonight, but...
Okay, yeah, yeah. So I'm like, looking around, I'm like,
Tuesday's the dud night. That's the bar dud night, because nothing's going on, but now basketball's trying to fill that void a little bit.
Okay, gotcha. I'll make sure to... It'll be coming up soon next week. So then, as of now, it is 46 degrees here in Chicago. It is going to be mostly cloudy, windy, and chilly with a high of 49 today. Going to be just a little bit breezy throughout the afternoon, chilling down a little bit as we get to a low of 40. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 73 degrees. A shower in spots this morning, otherwise sunny to partly cloudy and very warm, high of 93. Finally, for Chicago traffic, the usual suspects, and by that I mean the Kennedy, is not looking the worst today. However, it's still going to take you about 40 minutes if you're coming in all the way from O'Hare. Only real piece of news to report here is that, as we heard on the way in, Tom, let's see, it is Metro BNSF, inbound and outbound trains are on the move, but operating at restricted speeds due to an accident at Kedzie Avenue between 21st Street and 22nd Street, where a truck struck an overpass. So it's a little bit of train delays there. That's all.
You don't want to be going 80 miles an hour over a bridge that some truck just whacked into.
Yeah, that wouldn't be great.
Wouldn't be the best thing, no.
Back to you, Chief.
Russell, you know, two things that, you know, grade me on this, Prof.
That's my line.
What?
Somebody hits an overpass about once every couple of years on the BNSF. I'm just, I don't understand that. So, go ahead. That he just mentioned, that happens about, I feel like that would happen to me about once a year on that,
you know,
on that,
you know how many
line.
You know how many overpasses there are in the city for BNSF?
Oh, I know, no, yeah. And I used to take that train in, and I would, you know, I would go over all those streets. But I, you know who we need to complain to is Warren Buffett, because he owns that line.
Yeah, he does. You know, I was.
Yeah, he does. You were trying to call me on it because the train is your area.
You know, here's a weird old little story about being on TV. Me, I was on. Mm-hmm. They asked me to be on CNBC regarding Walmart earnings, which I don't really give a rat's behind. I mean, I do if my clients are involved. But so I get all dressed up and I get over there and I get the makeup on and all this kind of crap. So I'm on CNBC, and of course, Audrey, my significant other, all she used to do is tell me how lousy I look, because the little booth you're in, you can't see where the camera is, so you don't have an idea where you're looking. And there's no monitor even telling you who you're talking to, so if you don't know the people's voices, you don't even know who asked you the question. I mean, it was really bizarre.
Right.
So anyway, they start talking about Walmart earnings, and there's like four of us. So finally, the news comes across the tape, just so happens, that Warren Buffett had bought the Burlington Northern, the BNSF. And so they say something about, well, hey, Tom, what do you think of this? And I said, well, you guys just sort of just hit my wheelhouse, which, of course, they didn't want to hear. And I said, you know, this is, we're talking about this fracking starting up there. I said, we're talking about a major rail conglomeration in the first place. And I rattled off that the Burlington Northern is a combination of the Northern Pacific, Great Northern, Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy, and somebody else. And, of course, all I could see was everybody's mouth open. And I said, Warren Buffett's a smart guy. They essentially have a monopoly in that whole area, and now there's going to be this oil up there, and guess what? He's going to have a monopoly on oil shipments. They couldn't wait to get me off. Talk about getting the hook or the gong. They wanted no part of me talking about Warren Buffett buying a monopoly and knowing that the railroad actually was a combination of four railroads before that. They wanted none of that on the air. I was surprised.
No, you knew too much.
They wanted, yeah, it was, you know, here was a story, Warren's buying something, everything's cool. And which was cool. It was fine. He could do that. But they had no idea that the Burlington Northern now comprised four railroads. Right. I mean,
you know, I lost my respect for CNBC years ago when I was talking to one of their main people who's still on, and I was talking about something VIX oriented that they, you know, that they should highlight, and they said our viewers are not smart enough for that.
Yeah,
they said that to me, and I was just, are you kidding with me? You know, I say something other than that.
Well,
you know? say, well, that's kind of a technical issue, and we try not to you know, we want something that a good number of people know right off the bat, just something like that.
Well, that was a whole, that was their shtick. And Dr. J had this party one night, and I'm invited over, and that's when he first got on CNBC, and there's this producer on CNBC, and he goes, hey, Tom, we've had, you know, we had you on a couple times. We like having you on. We could have you on some more. And I said, well, you know, to be honest with you, I said, you know, I'm trade for people. And the last time you had me on, and you know, was talking about Walmart earnings, and there's four of us, and I got like three lines in, and it took me, you know, an hour and a half out of my day when I'm not watching the market for people, which is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it seems kind of weird. You never let anybody actually come to any kind of a conclusion or anybody really talk. And then all of a sudden you got four new people on there. And he says, well, yeah, that's what saved the station. I go, what saved the station? We keep the same subject going all day long. We don't anybody ever really wanted to take it to bed. We just keep the subject going. And I'm going, so we'll have four guys on talking about, you know, this merger. You never let any of them really talk about the history of the merger and what the companies do and what percentage of the new product line they have. You don't want anybody doing that. And all of a sudden you sweep those guys out and you have four new guys. You ask them the same question. They think they're keeping the ball rolling. But then again, they're not like Stocks and Jocks. We're trying to get to a conclusion that maybe people can trade on or people care about sport. They don't want that. They want to keep it going for 24 hours or 12 hours, wherever long they're at. It's just a different venue. It's not, I mean, anybody thinks it's news. I mean, the fact that you can turn it on and see what the market's doing and you'll get news flashes, that part's news. But the guests and stuff, they're there to feather their own nest. I mean, if you get the head of Exxon on there, you want him on first, after the earnings come out. But he's only going to answer a certain amount of questions. And if you hit him with a hardball one, there he's never coming back. I mean, that's, you know, that's his.
Yeah.
I mean, that's their shtick. Anyway, but get back to this Netflix. The thing that it kind of, not Netflix, so NVIDIA.
Yeah.
The thing that's concerning me about it, well, so this is just, it might not, I don't know if I can prove this, if I went to your guys' computers and had the people working like you do at IU. When I first started, I mean, everybody, especially if you came from the University of Chicago, I mean, you know, the market was a god. I mean, if the CEO went in the can and you heard some weird noises, you know, the idea would be somehow the market found out about it and the market would be down if there's something wrong with the CEO. That's what a belief people had in this everybody access of information. You know, you couldn't keep it quiet, you know, blah, blah, blah. And what used to happen is if you see a stock, you know, pick telephone or something, and all of a sudden the stock's nudging up toward earnings, the idea was the market somehow sniffed it out, whether some analyst had it or whatever. And then all of a sudden, the earnings that were supposed to be up 5% are up 7 or 8, just like you said about NVIDIA. And then, but then when the news came out, it actually was it buy the rumor, sell the news. It actually was okay. The stock belonged there, and it wouldn't go up anymore because now the announcement matched essentially the hype.
Yeah.
But now it's kind of totally different. You'll see NVIDIA come out, and like you say, they're growing 15%. Well, they better. It's $6 revenue per share, and they're trade 180. They better grow fast. So okay, they come out with next year it's $9 a share, and you're right, it's 50% higher. It's pretty damn good, right? But so you would say, okay, the stock is now growing into its price as you had predicted. It means it's not too expensive, and the 180 is justified, which I'm gonna roll with you on that. The problem is, when a guy comes out and says how good they're doing, the stock's now going to go to 250. So it's almost like, you know, your dog's chasing the rabbit in the race where you keep moving the rabbit, which is weird to me. I'm saying someplace along the line, I think we have a chance where these companies can grow into their price, but not if they keep going up 30% a year. How do you ever catch them?
Well, so, you know, I'm pulling up their. I'm actually trying to look at their model. Come on, there you go. Revenue. What'd you say their sales was?
$6, $6.50, something like that, per share.
Oh, you're doing per share.
Yeah.
I'm doing. Their revenue is $165 billion.
Yeah, but they got 25 billion shares outstanding or something.
Well, they're worth $4 billion, yeah, and their revenue is $165. See, you know, when we do this stuff in the classroom, we do it through for the whole market cap. So right now...
well, it's got to come out to the same number.
Yeah, it will. Right now, what is their freaking market cap? Where is that on this thing?
What's 181 times 25 bill?
Well, I can't do that in my head. It's early. Market cap is $4.4 billion.
Yeah.
So they're expected to do $98 billion in free cash flow next year, and that's going to grow by 47% into 27. If you assume that that slows to 10% by 2030, and you demand a 15% return on the stock, it's worth $4.125 billion right now. So it's not even 10% overpriced, and I consider those kind of conservative estimates.
Okay, and I have, like I said, I think these guys might be a winner in that regard, but the market's not going to be.
You said in five years. Their average cash flow growth for the last 5 years has been 47%.
I'm with you. Okay.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, but they went from $4 a share to $6. But here's what I'm talking about. I'm with you 100%. We're talking the same argument I just gave you, story.
I'm just trying to find.
I think you could very easily paint the rosy picture to where NVIDIA in 5 years, this 181, is the real price. Problem is, in 4 years, it's going to be 400. The way the market's moving. That's my concern. You know, if all this good stuff happens, and 3 years from now the stock's still 181, which nobody wants, you and I are going to say, guess what? The market did its job. It anticipated a price, and now we're here. But that's not what everybody wants. They want it doubled from there. Then what? Then the next 5 years got to be just as good as the last five. And somewhere, and the thing that there's three arrows coming at this thing. One is the growth is extraordinary, like you've stated. Second is stock, even though it's high, I actually think that compared to some of the other stocks they have the same valuation, this would be my horse. But now, if you listen to Carl yesterday, he was ranting and raving about how people are talking about this AI stuff and the stuff that NVIDIA makes, and they're putting like a 10-year life on these things, and they're valuing it. And he says, in all the years he's been in the business since he was 13, he started programming computers, nothing in this industry has ever been... You can't go out 10 years and say the NVIDIA stuff is still going to be the good stuff 10 years from now. He goes, everything has like a two-year. Somebody in that 10-year period is going to find something that is faster, doesn't take as much energy. He goes, you can't put a 10-year time horizon on this kind of development. And the other thing is, something has me very nervous with these guys, Russell. And the reason what it is, it's because of my Pullman background. The deal they did a couple of weeks ago where they bought into a place for like $100 billion and the place is going to turn around and buy $100 billion worth of stuff from themselves. It's like, it sounds to me like they're somehow or another they're padding their own backlog. It seems weird, doesn't it? I mean, they're lending money to people to buy stuff from them.
Well, so
it's kind of weird. I'm not saying it's wrong or anything like that. I'm just saying it makes me suspicious.
You can't think of NVIDIA like a you can't think of them like a tech company. I know this is going to sound kind of odd, but the way that you really want to think about them, as far as the product they make and in their sales, you want to compare them to Boeing, because their products are, you know, they have a very, very high ticket.
Yeah,
and there's a lead time on the orders as well, so they're also a very few, you know, they're not that many customers. They have a when I say not that many customers, they rely kind of like Boeing relies on big airlines, etc. You know, Microsoft, Facebook, Supermicro Computer, Amazon, and Google. If you add up their sales to those five guys, that's 50% of their revenue.
Which is dangerous.
Yeah, no, I know, and I don't disagree with that. But at the same time, you know, you're not talking about Jet Electro. I bet you don't remember where that company name comes from.
Jet Electro.
But Jet Electro, back from the 60s. You know, it's not like this fly-by-night customer. So you can balance that both ways as well. You know, but much like Boeing's got a limited number of customers
but
in the
Boeing,
world.
But Boeing does not, they don't walk to, you know, Air France and say, how about we lend you $8 billion and you buy $8 billion worth of planes?
You don't think Boeing?
They arrange it. They'll arrange it from somebody else.
I was going to say, you don't think they're involved in the financing part of that?
It's not the same as actually lending them the dough to buy your stuff. I'm saying it's a concern of mine. The reason why it is, I'll tell you the reason why it is that when I worked for Pullman and they were being purchased by Wheelabrator Frye, and we were having a big year in freight and passenger, we were doing crap in passenger, but we had a big year in freight, big year in trail mobile, which was truck trailers, and the freight stuff. Remember an outfit called ITEL?
Yeah,
ITEL. It back in those days, and maybe probably even today. I mean, you could be the Santa Fe. You'd say the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. You could go out and buy three boxcars, say. Now most of it's all containers, but say you bought three boxcars, brand new. Well, guess what? Mm-hmm. You may never see that boxcar again. Because it'd go west and it would go south and it'd be on somebody else's railroads for the next six. You knew where it was, and they would have to pay you rent for the thing every day. Well, ITEL said, why are we doing that? Why doesn't a firm just buy these things and lease them out? And wherever they are per day, we'll get paid, and the railroads don't have to buy their own boxcars. And it made sense. They were this huge leasing company. Well, 90% of the backlog at Pullman was ITEL's orders. And while we're writing this thing up for the Wall Street Journal summarizing Pullman's future plans, and Robin and I are doing most of the work, these guys go out of business while we're doing it.
Yeah.
And the vice president of finance goes, Robin says to the guy, this ITEL just went out of business. They're one of our backlog. We were predicting $1 billion in revenue. This is 1970-something for Pullman Freight in like 1977 or something. That billion was going to go to like a tenth of that, and the guy goes, "I don't know if they might come back in business. Use the billion. That's our backlog today. It hasn't been canceled yet." They published that number in the Wall Street Journal. So when you start pushing your own backlog like that, it's dangerous when you have only a few number of clients. And the healthiest business on earth is if you've got 500 clients, any one of which you could lose tomorrow and not bat an eyelash, right? That's you don't want three or four or five. You get away with it for a while, maybe forever. I'm just saying there are causes for concern. Russell, basically, what is my job for my people? It's to put them in stuff that's decent, watch out for the bumps in the road, and protect them. It's my job to worry, right? So I'm worrying. Just saying. Your job is a
decent. Yeah. That you can justify the current valuation on NVIDIA.
Yeah, I
was being pretty conservative when I did it.
Okay. Now you got to answer me this next question. I'm going to say if you did the same thing for Microsoft, you might come to the same conclusion. Same thing for Apple, same conclusion. Same thing for Oracle, how about that one? How about, a Palantir? How about Snow? Now, when you line up 10 of them and you can, with your brilliant professorial mind, you can find a way where every one of them is worth what they're worth. Now my next question is, can all 10 of them make it? Can they all be worth that much without us discovering another colony on Mars where there's another 30 million people or something?
I don't know. I haven't run it on those. All I did...
They're worse, but they're way worse, by the way.
All I did with NVIDIA was I took their cash flow growth, because that's how you value companies, based on their cash flow, and I extrapolated it out and had it slow by 10% a year over the next 5 years, and then discounted it back, assuming that you want twice the long-term average market return of 15%, and came up with a $4.215 trillion valuation for a company that's priced at 4.4.
Okay, I mean,
That's all I did. My student said, "How do you justify this?" And I said, "Well, let's download the model and do some work." And I, in about a 10-minute period, I said, "You know," and I wasn't even stretching the numbers.
Well,
at all. I felt like I was being pretty darn conservative.
Well, when you assume 40% and 50% growth compounded over 5 years, that's a stretch.
I didn't do that.
No. Right.
That's not what I did.
Well,
I assumed four. Right now, the Wall Street has their cash flow from their free cash flow growing by 50% year over year in 2026. And starting with 2027, I said, okay, let's say it starts slowing in 27, slows, by 10% a year through 30. That 50%'s not in the 50% that I threw out there, that's the last 5 years. That's not what I did going forward.
If I said
50% the next 5 years going forward, it was worth $7 trillion.
All right, so I guess
I didn't, and I'm not assuming that. What I'm assuming is that the business slows.
Well, we're kind of dancing around the same number, but I look at $6 a share in revenue, and if we go up 50% in 1 year,
that's not how you value this stock. You value it on cash flow.
Well, you
and it's trading at about 23 times cash flow, and it's been trading at 23 times cash flow the last 4 years.
Your cash flow can never be bigger than your revenue, right?
The free cash flow, where is that number?
It can't be any bigger than the revenue, because that's your cash. And you got to have some expenses.
Yep.
Anyway, I'm winging another one at you here. PLTR, mm-hmm. Palantir. Stock is trading.
I don't know anything. I know nothing about
that. I'm just running one at you. It's trading 180. It's roughly the same price as NVIDIA, which makes me think you're right about the NVIDIA. Guess what their revenue per share is?
I don't know. Where is that income statement?
Buck 30. I'll take the 6 at NVIDIA over to buck 30. I'm with you on that. Mm-hmm. Can you even imagine it? But I don't know. The company might be sitting on a gold mine, right? Literally.
Yeah, I don't know anything about them.
They're expensive. they're high.
Yeah, but I mean, I just don't. I've heard their name a few times, and I am. See, the thing is, I rarely pay attention to any individual stocks.
Me too. I'm with you on eggs. Well, actually, that's not true.
NVIDIA, when I got the student asked me the question, I said, "All right, well, let's do what we've been doing in class tonight. See what we come up with." I think they were kind of shocked that using, they were giving me faster growth than I put in there, and I said, "No, let's be really conservative. That way, if the number didn't look too bad, we feel good about it."
Well, I say the individual stocks that I look at are ones my clients have. You know, those I got to make sure I'm totally involved with. And some stocks have not. Boy, we've had some concentrated issues. Russell, we had a lot of UPS. Boy, what a dog that thing has been. And we've had ACN. Accenture has been. It's down $100 in a year. I mean, some of these stocks, individual stocks. It's not every one of them is doing this. Oh, hey, I know what I wanted to ask you. Kramer was mentioning the other day, I happened to listen to him because I was at the ATM machine, and he was talking about how, you and I have discussed on many occasions that it's really hard. I mean, I have a couple clients that their stocks are in, everybody's got a lot of Apple, okay, no matter what firm you have, if you have, I'll use the term regular people. Apple's got to be the most widely held of these stocks among regular people that you and I would know. A lot of people bought Apple when it was 20 and 25. It was a name back then. You're going to find more people on Apple than on Nvidia, right? With retail people. Same thing with Amazon or Tesla. You might have some people, but Apple's a real stalwart. So it's almost to the point where if somebody says my portfolio is Apple, Microsoft, even some Nvidia, you almost can't say, let's lighten up on these things and buy the Qs, you're buying the same thing. Because they're like 50% of the Qs. And Kramer was talking about how, my hat's off to him, he said if you take all the AI, essentially all the AI crap, your Oracle, your Palantir, your even Snow, if you take those 15, 20 AI stacks, they're making up like 70% now of the QQQ's value. And he just thought that was just way too high. That AI is, it's a big deal, but in terms of how much it's actually going to make these companies at the prices they are now. He says, you know, it's to be determined whether they actually make as much money as the hype has gone into it. He goes, it's almost like the Qs and these indexes are so AI pushed at this point that they're almost, you almost got to be careful of them. What do you think of that?
Well, the problem with AI and saying, you know, that there are two different types of AI companies. There's NVIDIA, who is supplying to all these people that think they're right. going to make money through AI. And then there's Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta, Google, who all believe that their AI services are going to be monster revenue generators, and they're going to be able to pay for all this capital equipment that they need to get their AI offerings up and, you know, out there. And those companies are the ones that I would be very, very concerned about. There's this old South Park episode where one of the kids is having his underwear stolen by a gnome. And he follows the underwear gnome, and the whole plan of the underwear gnomes is to steal underwear and make profits. And he's like, well, where are the profits coming from? And they all look completely dumbfounded. I'll bet you ask some CEOs of companies that think they're going to make a lot of money with AI, exactly how that's going to work, and you're going to get the same blank stare. I remember all the exchanges, 20, 25 years ago talking about, maybe 15 years ago, talking about how blockchain was going to revolutionize and streamline all the trade clearing.
Yeah.
That ain't happening. And you know why it's not happening? Because you can't correct mistakes in blockchain.
Well, that's interesting. Hey, so in other words...
it's the same thing. It's like blockchain is going to revolutionize our industry. It's going to help our margins, blah, 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 blah. You know, all the exchanges were saying that. Never really? Came true.
So you're, to go way, way, way back, you're saying out of this whole group, NVIDIA, those other guys, the Meta, the Googles...
The other guys are the customers right now.
I'm going to say that they're
it's just like Pets.com having to buy a whole crap load of equipment to launch their site.
Well, I was going to take you back 200 more years. They're the gold miners, and you're saying NVIDIA is the guys selling them the shovels and the blue jeans.
They are the folks that are selling them the blue jeans and starting up Stanford University.
That's interesting. We started this whole conversation by me saying, out of all these places that are valued this high, I think NVIDIA might be the winner.
Yeah, and they're the ones that I'm concerned the least about. But if I hear Microsoft say we made it, if I'm listening to an earnings call, you know, I'm back in my hedge fund days and I'm listening to an earnings call and trying to react to some of the things that are being said. If I hear anybody from Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, Google, those really are the ones that matter. If I hear any of them say we're reassessing our AI spending or something like that, I'm shorting the crap out of NVIDIA.
Yeah. Because
it was the crack in internet was drying up of spending to Cisco and EMC.
Well, so, the thing we're all saying the same subject. The same, and I keep talking about the 2000 thing because I was so close to it. At clients, I mean, but the we're at valuations here. I think Russell and you, by the way, did a pretty nice job on the NVIDIA. Which, if I had done the calculation, I bet I would have come out in the same place. If you assume the growth that they have is going to hang in there for a while, I'm with you. But what gets to me is something like, I mean, look at Microsoft. It's 519, all right? And they're doing fine. I mean, the company, you know, I have issues with antitrust and so forth. But here's my point. If tomorrow we all walked in and it was trading, I'm not saying zero, but it was trading 450 instead of 519, I think you and I would have a real tough time putting together a paper saying this stock has got to be worth 520 or 519, and that this 450 is a ridiculously cheap price, because I don't think it would be, would it? And I'm saying same thing with NVIDIA. If you came in tomorrow and it was 165, I don't know if you'd say, wow, this thing is so incredibly undervalued that we got to start buying, we're selling the kids off to buy it. That's kind of where I am with some of these prices.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you agree with that at all. I mean, I'm saying some of this stuff, I mean, I look at a Palantir. I happen to like the company. It's 180, but If all of a sudden tomorrow was 170, I wouldn't sell my truck and buy some. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
You're not going to back up the truck.
No. I mean, it's not like back in 2000 and some other days where 2007 where you sat there and go, how the hell could this stock be $20? It's got to be worth 50. I mean, these guys would have to go down quite a bit for me to feel that way, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, the whole market's expensive. We know that. The whole market is ridiculously expensive. I think like 8 of the top 10 stocks in the Russell 2000 have some sort of AI relationship now as well.
Yeah. Because
everybody's trying to find another, it feels like it's fully priced into all the very large cap stocks. So, big number of the biggest company in the Russell 2000 is less than 1% of the index, but we
got a dash. But I tell you, in 1981, when I came in, of course, I was bullish way too early as we started the conversation. The company, when you're paying 12% on treasuries and 15% in the bank, the stocks were priced that they were, most of them were like 8 times earnings, and they were paying like an 8 or 9% dividend. That's how cheap the stocks were. And you sit there and go, God, if these rates ever come down, these things are going to double like in a day. But it took 18 months for me to be here before they made a move. Boy, talk about being early. It was crazy, Russell. I mean, that's why I have these visions in the back of my head that if all of a sudden the Fed messes up here, if they do, or they keep putting money supply in and the CPI gets out of control, I look at this 10-year rate and all these prices of these stocks, if that 10-year rate, if that's 7%, none of these stocks are here. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the danger, right? When you put money into the system. And I mean, can you imagine where they'd be priced if that 10-year went to 12 like it was before?
I can't.
I can't either. I don't want to see that.
Heaven forbid that happens. And that actually is why I'm typically jumping over to the interest rate stuff whenever I see things going on with the market. Because if suddenly it looks like we're not going to get any more cuts, and that's going to, right off the bat, that would have a negative impact on stocks.
Are you here or are you in Indiana? Because we got a dash. Where are you?
I'm at home in Chicago.
By the way, I loved meeting you guys when you came in.
Yeah.
The doctor is adorable. Absolutely adorable.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
And very bright. Disarmingly bright. I like that.
I know. yeah.
We're talking about Dr. Demiak, who she's been on.
You never see that one coming.
I'm not surprised after having her on the show.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe you in the suit and the Donald Trump tie. I love that.
I was looking like a grown-up.
You look like you were you didn't look like an undertaker. You look good. You didn't look like a, what do they say in the South Side, a bereavement counselor? You heard that term?
I have. I have a friend who is one.
Oh, God. They used to be undertakers. We used to know a guy who his name all through high school was Formaldehyde Jack. How would you like that for your name? Anyway, good luck. Have a good week. We'll talk to you soon. S&P futures up 4, NASDAQ futures down 38. We'll see what happens today. Gold's still down. We'll see if it bounces. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.